Okay, thank you, Guano. Yeah, morning, everyone. Yeah, I'm glad to be here to present my research on the SWOT modeling in the Tennessee River Basin. So we want to examine the effects of biomass production on water quantity and also quality in the Tennessee River Basin. So, yeah, as Guano has just introduced, I'm from the Oak Ridge National Lab, and my division, like a department, is Environmental Science Division. Yeah, actually, I'm doing both at the global scale and land surface modeling, and also watershed scale and water hydrologic modeling work. So now in the U.S., also in worldwide, I think we are having a lead to grow biomass for bioenergy production. So one of the key questions that how this kind of transition from traditional land use to the bioenergy crops will influence the water quantity and the water quality in the system. In addition, this is a part of the big project. In addition to the water quantity and the quality, we are also interested in the like soil quality and also greenhouse gas emission and also biodiversity. So here, I will focus on the water quantity and the water quality in the Tennessee River Basin. So you can see that there are all kinds of bioenergy crops from agriculture. For example, we have the energy crops and also crop residues. Okay, here, particularly in Tennessee River Basin, actually, we will focus on three kinds of transition. So three major bioenergy crops are the switchgrass, miscanthus, and also the wheeler. So all of them are cellulosic bioenergy crops. So our general method used the SWOT modeling. So Tennessee River Basin is a tributary of the Mississippi River. So you can see that it is still a large river basin here. So we have the inputs for the model, like the elevation data, and also the soil data, and also crop data layer, or we say the land use data input to the model. In addition to that, we use the hydrological units, HOC 8, and that means 8-digit numbers for each for each unit. We also use the daily climate data to drive the model. Very specifically, in the Tennessee River Basin, we have a lot of reservoirs here. I don't know how many, maybe around 100. However, here in the model, we incorporate like 22 big reservoirs in the model. This is one of the characteristics from the SWOT modeling, because usually we are modeling the natural system. However, when we have the reservoirs in the system, I think that the water regime has been changed since we have to regulate the water discharge from the reservoirs. So first, when we want to do the this kind of environmental impact analysis, first we need to calibrate the model. That means we need to have a good model to do the projections. So that's why we use the baseline. We call the baseline. So we use the crop data layer. It's like a land use data map from the 2009 to drive the model and to calibrate and evaluate the model in terms of like the water quantity, runoff, and sediment, and the total phosphorus, total nitrogen, and also inorganic nitrate. So after we have a good calibration and validation of the model, we will use the projections. So we have two projections we will talk about, I will talk about later. So we will use, that means we just replace land use map in the SWOT model and to see what kind of changes has been resulted from this kind of land use change. So the for the SWOT models, I think previously a speaker has introduced all kind of automatic calibration tool. Here we directly integrate the kind of optimization algorithm into a SWOT model, also used in the source code of SWOT model, and that means the Fortune code. So here, I don't want to go to details of this kind of algorithm. Generally, a direct integration of this kind of algorithm into the SWOT source code can greatly improve the computational performance of the model. For example, now, I think within 24 hours, majorly for this Tennessee River Basin, we have 55 sub-basins. We can, generally, we can complete the calibration processes. Otherwise, we need to we need more time, computational resources to complete the calibration of the model. So here, first, I want to calculate runoff. Actually, I use the USGS computated runoff. Why I use runoff, not stream flow, as I have introduced at the beginning? Because we have 22 reservoirs into the model. So actually, it's not realistic to calculate stream flow at the stream flow gauge. Because actually, basically, the stream flow at each gauge actually is controlled by the upstream reservoir discharge. So here, we use the computated runoff at each hot eight. We said totally there are 32 hot eights in the Tennessee River Basin. And also, we delineated the whole watershed into the 50 and 55 sub-basins. That means, for example, we have in each hot eight, actually, we have 1 to 4 sub-basins. So we use 1 year data, so 1985 for model spin-up. And also we calibrate the model with 10 years and all the validated the runoff for 18 years. Why we start from 1985? Because we only have the data reservoir and discharge data collected from TVA and only start from 1985. So the lower part, you can see that lower left shows the performance of the model. This is like the coefficient determination. And the first one, the left column shows the green one shows the calibration. You can see that the average is like around 0.8. And also we have the validation in the middle, the blue one. And also the red one, third column, shows the performance during the whole study period. That means from the 1986 to the 2013. So I calculated the percent of bows. You can see that the bows is around, I think, within the 20% generally. So according to the one of the publications defined what is a satisfactory model from SWART, you can see that the ASE, like a coefficient of determination, generally greater than 0.5, and the p-bows within the 25%, and that means the model is satisfactory. So from here, based on this, I would say that the model and calibration and validation are very successful and also satisfactory. So the right side and the spatial distribution of the top one shows the runoff from each sub-basin, and also the lower part shows the runoff coefficient from each sub-basin. So here we just demonstrated some of the temporal results from the two of the hot eights. Actually, you can see that we have 32 hot eights. So we have the calibration period and also we have the validation period, and we can see that we have got very good results for both the calibration and also the validation. So next one, so the most difficult one for the water quality. So actually for the calibration of the model, so we have two steps. The first step, we calculate the parameters controlling the hydrologic processes. That means only controlling the runoff, like a stream flow, this kind of processes. The second step, we will fix those kind of parameters just for water quantity, and then calculate the water quality parameters. And this, the water quality, we will focus on like the sediment and lesion and phosphorus. So here, so we have the computational runoff water quantity data from USGS. However, for water quality, even though we have a lot of observations in this watershed, however, the long-term time series of the water quality data is still very limited. So here, we still use a kind of, we call it observation. Actually, it's not observation. It's a kind of data generated from observations. They use the LODIS, they call it the LODIS dataset. Okay, the LODIS dataset, we have the data from the 1997, you can see that to 2011. So we also calculate these kind of things. So generally, actually, if you want to see the coefficient of determination, actually, okay, it's very bad for water quality. It's so difficult to calculate water quality data. However, if you see the p-bows generally, so we can, for example, for sediment, the p-bows is within the absolute value of the p-bows within the 50%. And also for phosphorus and nitrogen, you can see that they are within the, maybe the 75%. However, you can see that this is a large bowels for the inorganic nitrogen. Nitrate, you can see that the P bowels is, I think it's larger than 100 even. You can see that. So generally, I think for the total nitrogen, the total phosphorus, and also sediment, so you can see that from the P bowels point of view, you can see that the model is still satisfactory. However, for inorganic nitrogen, yeah, the model performance still needs to be further be improved. So here, the lower part, we also show the temporal dynamics of that. This is the sediment, yeah, and also we have the total phosphorus and the total nitrogen. Okay, so here we also show the distribution. You can see that actually, generally, the I think the left one shows the left top shows the sediment, the right top shows the total phosphorus, and the lower part shows the total nitrogen and also the inorganic nitrogen nitrate. You can see that actually the phosphorus generally follow the pattern of sediment, not because in the during the carbon and this and when we use the baseline land use, actually the state and the phosphorus associated with sediment dominant the system. Okay, and also the nitrogen actually the during when we use the baseline land use map, actually also the nitrate inorganic nitrogen dominant the total nitrogen. That means I think it's around 85 to 90% of the total nitrogen. So here we also compare the spatial distribution between our modeling study with the spiral data set. So this another data set, yeah, they also use a kind of regression method to produce the spatial distribution of the whole watershed. So left top shows the box, this kind of box plot shows the total nitrogen. The left one, the green one, shows the results from the SWOTA model. We use the long-term means for each sub-basin. The spiral data set, you can see that for total nitrogen, actually they correlated with each other very good. The right one also shows the P bowels, that means the percent of bowels between the two data sets. You can see that basically most of them are within the 75%. You can see that. However, this D is still, you can see that in the middle string of the watershed, the blue color shows that there's still some sub-watershed we have a higher, like a greater than 70% of the P-bowels between our modeling results and the spiral data set. However, for total phosphorus, it's not so, it's good. There's no good agreement with the two models. However, you can see that for the total phosphorus, actually, SWOT modeling produced a higher simulation results for total phosphorus than the spiral data set. However, you can see that the OP and SP, and that means the organic phosphorus and then the soluble phosphorus, you can see that it seems the quantity, they are comparable to each other. So next step, we want to do the scenario analysis. We have said that we have a carbon model and also valid model. Okay, we want to see the responses of this kind of water quantity to land use change. So we have said we have three scenarios. First one is the baseline, the second one we call it BC1. Third one is HH3. I mean, the two future scenarios, actually, they are related to different scenarios for bioenergy crop production. You can see that. Okay, the lower part, you can see that the major transition of the land use. And majorly, you can see that a decrease in the hay. However, we have an increase in the bio crops. This bio crops includes three major crops. Three major ones. The first one is wheat grass, the second one is canthus, and the third one is willow. So left spatial distribution shows the wheat grass area, percentage area of wheat grass in this basin. You can see that for the top one shows the baseline. There are very limited wheat grass in the system. However, in the future scenario, we have like 1 to 4%, maybe average 4% of the wheat grass in the whole system. So here we show the percent change due to land use change. Actually, the result from the BC1, the future scenario, BC1 and the HH3, they are very similar. However, when we compare the future post-bioenergy BC1, for example, to the pre-bioenergy baseline, we can see that the runoff actually has been reduced. It's like averagely 15%. However, there's no significant influence on the TSS, that means sediment loading. However, there's a great improvement in total phosphorus and also lysine. Yeah. So here we show that we want to see what's the major reason for that. You can see that we have done the correlation analysis between the water quantity and the water quality with the land use. Here we use the delta, that means percent change in the water quantity and also percent change in the land use area. You can see that the bio crops actually contribute to the change in runoff and also the nitrogen. However, the sediment, you can see that from the sediment and the phosphorus, we cannot see. Only the willow has a higher impact on the organic phosphorus and the soluble phosphorus. So we have a summary here. So basically, I think that the Tennessee River Basin holds promise for producing cellulosic feedstocks and also improve the water quality, especially for lysine and phosphorus, however, not sediment. So last I want to acknowledge my supporting funding agencies and also my colleagues contributing to this project. Okay, thanks for your attention.